This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
A subject we've hit on a lot here is the challenge of reviving inner city schools and giving those students equal opportunities with more affluent districts. Funny thing, that's happening right now.
I saw one of the best early education programs in the country. I mean, a place that you wish you were 3 years old again.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about some improbable scholars turning around a school system in New Jersey. We'll also meet a man who keeps a school system musical without playing a single note, hear commentary about keeping things fun, and spend an academic minute learning about yesterday's climate on today's Hudson River. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Statistically speaking, most of our youngsters will continue to be educated in mainstream public schools. The good news, as education writer David L. Kerp reveals in his book, Improbable Scholars, is that there's a sensible way to rebuild public education and close the achievement gap for all students. Indeed, this is precisely what's happening in a most unlikely place, Union City, New Jersey, a poor, crowded Latino community just across the Hudson from Manhattan. The school district, once one of the worst in the state, has ignored trendy reforms in favor of proven game changers like quality early education, a word-soaked curriculum, and hands-on help for teachers. David Kerp recently spoke with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue, who asked what put this school on his radar.
It's early education program. I had worked in the Obama transition team on early education, and I'd heard about Union City. I went there, and I saw one of the best early education programs in the country. I mean, a place that you wish you were 3 years old again. Life is so exciting there. And while I was there, I thought, let me look and see what's happening in the rest of the school system. I was impressed by the quality of teaching, the kind of energy the teachers had, the engagement of the kids, and I wanted to find out more. So I arranged to spend a year there.
And in spending a year there, what did you know going in, and what were you hoping to learn, and what blanks were you hoping to fill in?
That's a great question. I knew that the test scores were great. I knew the preschool was great. And I knew the district was very tight. It's a very, you know, think New Bedford of New Jersey. It's a very tight community. It's a Latino community. And I knew that that mattered a lot. But I didn't know how the system worked. If you think of education, school systems, it's like a Swiss watch. You know, when academics study these places, they basically take one piece of the watch and hold it up to the light. I wanted to see how the whole mechanism worked. And I had no idea how it worked. I had no idea how a school functioned, what was going on in a particular classroom, how the system operated. And that's what I wanted to learn about. But I also wanted to learn about the politics, because you're in Hudson County, New Jersey, which is famous or infamous for its political machine.
So how much of it do you think is, before we get into the specifics, how much of it do you think comes from the mechanics and conscious decisions, and how much of it is the makeup of the community, the tightness of that community, and the people who are in charge, which is a long way of asking how easy is it to replicate it?
Well, when I finished working in Union City, I knew that would be the first question that thoughtful people would ask. Is this a nice story about a mid-sized New Jersey city?
Yeah.
Which doesn't work anyplace else. And so I went looking around the country for school districts, big, little, with or without unions, with or without mayorally controlled school boards, well-funded, not well-funded, that were doing well. That is, they were doing better than the demographic odds would suggest in terms of improving achievement and closing the achievement gap. And what I found, whether I was in Montgomery County, Maryland, a very rich community with a very poor inner neighborhood, or Aldine, Texas, a place that nobody's ever heard of, it's Houston's poor cousin, but it has more students than Boston, or Long Beach, California, which is the third biggest city in California, what I found in all these places, what they were doing essentially the same thing. They had built a system of supports, and you began describing it in your opening, from kindergarten through high school. And they were doing that without flash and dazzle. They were doing it without the kind of inspirational hero leaders who ride in on a white horse and, you know, work their way with the system. They were building. They were slowly and steadily building a system that worked, and that the community embraced, and that the teachers embraced, and that the kids embraced.
One of the things that you take out of this is that the old model that we've been operating under isn't a bad one.
The old model isn't a bad one if it ever was actually executed properly.
Right.
What happened under the old model is that nominally you had this hierarchy. I mean, the superintendent is kind of the general or the CEO, but it's more like the dozy Ottoman Empire, where the wazir is off in Istanbul and everybody's doing his own thing, and the schools were doing their own thing. It's kind of a loose confederacy, and so you'd have islands of excellence amid lots of mediocrity. And so you had a system of schools. And what Union City has managed to do is to build a system, and you're right, it's old school. They're using strategies that any educator with a pulse is going to be familiar with.
So when you think about the, and I want to get into leadership, because there are programs and there are different ideals, but you do talk in the book about those in charge not intimidating, but ultimately being cheerleaders for every member, both for the students and the staff and the teachers of that school.
That's really right. I mean, who responds to intimidation except a mule? And whatever else you'd say about teachers, and I think they're wonderful. They really are some of the heroes of the book. You know, that's not what works for them. What works for them is giving them a chance to be professionals, encouraging them to collect, them to collaborate, providing mentors, more experienced teachers to help out the newbies, providing coaches who actually come in the classroom and work with these teachers. It's a kind of watch one, do one, teach one model that works in those schools. And one of the things that struck me so powerfully is that these aren't fancy teachers with great pedigrees who are flying in to save the universe. These are locals. And that's true across America, that most of the teachers in Union City were born, have grown up, went to college, and came back to live within maybe an hour's commute of the school that they're teaching in. And they have learned a ton of the job, and they know that the school system has their back. They know that the school system doesn't have a knife at their back.
I mean, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, but in old school, new school. But I couldn't help in reading the book thinking that so much of this seems to be common sense.
You got it. It absolutely is common sense.
Why don't we do it? Why? How did we get off that path then?
Take an example. These kids are immigrant kids. A third of them probably have come here without papers. You know, 75% of them are growing up in homes where the telenovela and not the reality TV show is on, and where Spanish is the language of the table. So what do you need to do with such kids? If you happen to be in California, where ideology reigns, you say, hey, we're not going to teach you Spanish, kid. Too bad. We're going to start you out in English because you're in America. If you're in Union City, you do what the linguists tell you to do. They really focus on getting kids fluent in their native language because that's an important base, and then transitioning gradually to English. Why don't most places do this? Because on the one hand, the good news is that, as you say, it's common sense. The bad news is that it's hard work. I mean, that old maxim, 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration, it's absolutely true. And when I talk about the administration, that chapter is entitled Grunt Work. Because it's a lot of just keeping everybody connected, just making sure that people don't drift off. Just, when, for example, the test results come back, you want to make sure that the principal not only shares them with the teachers, but has some ideas as to how to improve the weaknesses that those test results have revealed. That is constant grinding work. It never ends. And another thing is, if you're a place like Union City, you're constantly, continuously improving. I mean, in that sense, it's very much like business. It's not the kind of intimidation business that the market modelers talk about, but it's how successful businesses work. You keep doing what's working, and you keep looking around for ways of improving at the margin. And that's something that district has done. And it's hard. It also, the other thing that is crucial in the story is stability. Union City has had two superintendents in the past 25 years, and the present one is showing no signs of departing. That's more stable than almost any place else I can think of. But the typical urban district runs through superintendents, in less than 3 years. You can't, I don't care how good you are, how enthusiastic you are, you can't lead a school system effectively if you're going to be out the door in 3 years. So getting a school board or a mayor and a school system on the same page and realizing that it can't be done overnight, that this is a 25-year story, slow, steady improvement over 25 years. I mean, it can be done faster than that, but it can't be done overnight. I mean, if you know, we should learn a lesson from Bernie Madoff, right? If it sounds too good to be true, it is too good to be true. You know, so when you get a stupid tenant like Michelle Rhee in Washington, D.C., saying, you know, look, I've turned around the place in a year and a half, it just can't be right. And, you know, as the test score results that are coming out now, the new analyses are showing it wasn't right.
Yeah. And we're just about out of time, but one of the other points when you talk about that stability is the importance you write about of having teachers who are part of that community, have been a longstanding part of that community, and really ultimately developing a farm team for future teachers who will come from that district to teach in that district.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, I think two things are really important there. One is that the teachers, you have generations of kids who are growing up there and nearby who want to stick around and who are going to teach. Also, the administrators come from inside. They're, that's where the farm team is as well. So the principal of the high school was a lifer. The superintendent was a lifer as well. They rose up the system. They learned how things work. Another factor that we ought to touch on is the parents. They are more engaged in Union City than any place I know, and they get a lot of support from the school. In turn, the school demands a lot from them in terms of working with their kids, helping their kids. And it works. I mean, there is huge trust. If there are two words I want the listeners to take away from this, is patience. It takes time. And trust. You've got to build a culture of trust. And it doesn't just happen. You've got to earn it if you're a school system.
David Kerb's book is called Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue.
Because everybody needs an education. Everybody needs an education. Skin, red skin, yellow or white. Everybody needs to read and write. Everybody needs an education.
Keeping things fun can be as important as any other aspect of education. And that's something that Jerry Burns was reminded of one day when talking to a special school principal.
In March, my husband Barry and I had a surprise while visiting an elementary school to do a storytelling assembly. It wasn't a pop quiz, but it did make our eyes pop, quizzically. While we arranged our sound system in the gym, the principal entered. We were delighted. Rarely do we meet principals in the flesh. They are often in meetings or stashed away like good wine for special occasions. This principal looked like a male principal archetype. Dark pants, button-down shirt, belt that had more to do with decorum than function. He walked with the relaxed yet sure gait of a leader who feels at home in his skin and in his role. His handshake and smile were warm. We asked if there were specific school topics that he wanted us to address in our show, like character education words of the month, particular literary connections, or social studies themes. With a spunky yet earnest glint in his eye, he said, "Forget about that stuff. I want those kids to have fun." Have fun. That's a phrase I wouldn't expect in a principal's conversation starter handbook. I was dying to see Barry's reaction, but I didn't want to be obvious. Keeping my head still enough to win a gold medal in an Olympic game of freeze tag, my eyes migrated to the left. They stretched so far that I feared that one eyeball would sever its relationship with my optic nerve and rudely tumble from my face like a marble rolling off a table. Barry was looking at me in exactly the same way, with question marks for eyeballs. So much for subtlety and the sideways glance. I asked, "Did you say you want them to have fun?" He nodded. "These kids have so many things that they have to do, so many shoulds and musts. Children need to play. I want them to have a blast with you. That's all." Wow! We haven't encountered a principal like him lately, one willing to admit that there are too many pressures placed on youngsters. Here was a real, live administrator suggesting that children have opportunities during school to revel in the lightness of being. It's not that I believe educators forget this. Regulations and extensive testing have tied the hands of teachers, forced learning to fit into a box, and have made the fun of learning less of a pedagogical imperative. This is the complaint we hear again and again from teachers, and this is what made the news just days after our school visit. According to the Albany Times Union, the school board in Saratoga Springs is sending a message back to New York State saying that enough is enough with testing. Apparently, this sentiment goes beyond Saratoga and beyond educators to parents and students, too. More and more people support the idea that educators teach to hearts and minds, not to the test. And now, back to our principal. He wanted his students to have fun. We gladly honored his request, but we did what we always do. We selected stories that fit the mood and age of the audience. The tales had laughter, surprises, and interesting images. Threaded throughout was educational content, along with the developmental good stuff that oral storytelling offers for brains, language, emotional intelligence, memory, and listening skills. Students had fun learning that day in the multipurpose gymatorium, just as the principal wanted, and just as they always do when they hear stories told. I am glad that educators are standing up for the teaching they want to be doing, like the principal we met in March.
Dr. Jerry Burns has been working together with Barry Marshall as the Story Crafters since 1991, and they've both been storytellers longer than that. You can learn more about them at storycrafters.com. Still to come, an important member of a school music department doesn't need to play a single note. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1188. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Student musicians in Durham, North Carolina depend on Caden Jenkins Deal, but not in the way you might expect. He's not a band director. He's not a conductor. He's not a private music teacher. Co-producers Lee Buxom and Grace West bring you the story of an instrument repairman who flies under the radar.
People that play saxophone for a living, that's their art. I try to keep their saxophones going.
I've been repairing for the Durham school system probably for about 6 years now, and I've picked up just about all of the public middle schools and high schools in Durham. I don't really take time off. I work almost every day. I work sometimes 10 or 12 hours a day, but I love what I do. So, you know, it's, I think it was George Lucas who said, if you get up in the morning and you go to work, and then you realize you're hungry, and it's like you look at the time, and you realize it's been about 10 hours since you ate, then you love what you do. I can make just about anything play. We actually had a flute that the bottom half of the flute is called the foot joint, got crushed by a bus, and it was flat, and we got it back round. So it's moving. To the best of my knowledge, it's still playing somewhere. Jordan High School, they did their spring concert, and I had just finished doing all of their marching brass. And the first thing they do is bring up their marching band, and I watched them go up, and I was like, there are my horns. They may belong to Jordan High School, but I polished and cleaned every one of them. Instruments should be cleaned on a regular basis, especially brass instruments, because if you think about it, you know, the little keys, they call them water keys. They're not water keys. They're spit valves, because you're blowing through the instrument constantly, and you have acid in your mouth, and you will actually dissolve your own instrument from the inside out. Actually, that's what happened here. This horn is dissolved from the inside out. I can play a chromatic scale on everything. I almost passed out the first time I tried to play an oboe. I got lightheaded playing flutes. I was like, you just never think about these things as being hard to play. It was like, oh, sure, it's a flute. It can't be that hard, right? Oh, my Lord. Yes, it is very hard to play. So actually, the bigger the instrument, to me, the easier it is to play. The easiest thing is tuba, if you can get the first note out of a tuba, if you think of all the plumbing that goes in it. But the smaller the instrument, the harder they are to play. Piccolos. Piccolos are difficult. Flutes, clarinets, lots of clarinets.
The guy that trained me, he always said our best work was never seen, and that is so true. I've had instruments in here that are 100 years old, and they're still playing. So you take care of them, and they will last you forever.
This piece by co-producers Lee Buxom and Grace West was produced for the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. If you want to get a clue about the climate of the past, take a look at the Hudson River. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. From tree rings to ice cores, nature has a number of ways of recording climate change. And as Dorothy Petit, research scientist at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, explains, one of the world's most iconic rivers has a tale to tell, too.
Major droughts are rare in recent New York memory. But sediments built up in marshes and lake beds over centuries can tell us about climate in the more distant past. My colleagues and I explore the Hudson River's many marshes, from New York City to wilder sites further north. We use canoes, rubber boots, and big hollow augers to pull up plugs of layered mud. Back in the lab, we sift through and extract pollen, spores, and seeds. Counting the abundance of different types at different times with the microscope tells us what past forests were like, and by extension, what the climate was like. For instance, oaks and hemlocks common today require a lot of moisture. Other trees, such as pine and hickories, tend to live in drier times. The cores indicate that several mega-droughts have occurred in the last 6,000 years. The longest one lasted 500 years, from 850 to 1350 AD. As less rain fell, the flow of the Hudson River ebbed, and salt water from the sea moved further upriver. A salty signature stays in the sediment. Forest fires raged, as indicated by a thick layer of charcoal from this time. This happened during the medieval warm period, when now long-gone Viking settlements on Greenland basked in warmth. That gives us evidence that this drought was connected to widespread higher temperatures at that time. The last major New York drought occurred from 1961 to 1963. Back then, the water supply of New York City went from full to one-quarter of capacity in just 2 years. If history repeats itself, New York's now much larger population would be severely affected. How can we better prepare ourselves? One way is to determine how often severe droughts have happened and why. This will help us to predict them and to prepare for the climate of the future.
That was Dorothy Petit of Columbia University.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. And that's all the time we have for The Best of Our Knowledge. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Thanks for being with us. And so long from The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.